It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Alan Sullivan is the co-author, along with Joe Cox, of Voice of the Wildcats, Claude Sullivan and the Rise of Modern Sportscasting. Alan is the son of Claude Sullivan, who broadcast Wildcat games from 1947 to 67, was also a voice of the Cincinnati Reds, called Thoroughbred Racing, established his own company, and founded the Standard Oil network of stations that broadcast UK games. Claude Sullivan was named Kentucky's Outstanding Broadcaster by the National Association of Sportscasters and Sportswriters from 1959 through 1964. He received the Golden Mike Award from the Kentucky Broadcasters Association in 1967. He is a member of the Kentucky Journalism Hall of Fame and the UK Athletics Hall of Fame. Claude Sullivan died of cancer in December 1967. He was only 42 years old. Alan Sullivan has achieved great success in the field of healthcare architecture. He has worked on more than 80 private, academic, and federal hospitals and medical facilities. Alan is a frequent speaker at healthcare conferences. He is a member of the American Institute of Architects National Committee of Architects for Health and is one of 400 people across the country licensed by the American College of Healthcare Architects. As a teenager, he assisted Claude on UK broadcasts and enjoyed the experience of being around the UK sports programs as well as the Major League Baseball scene when Claude was with the Reds. Well, here's our conversation with Alan Sullivan. Well, Alan, we had a chance to talk about Claude Sullivan's career pretty extensively at the panel we did back in November with some of the other broadcasters on the subject of the history of UK sports broadcasting. But it's great to have you back and take a little closer look at Claude's career and your experiences growing up as his son at that time. So we appreciate you taking time to come back and talk with us.
Thanks, Keith. I enjoyed the last one. I'm grateful that you asked me back. It was a lot of fun.
That panel, by the way, is available on the WUKY Sports page, web page that has all of our podcasts, and I think you'll enjoy listening to that one as well, the history of UK sports broadcasting. But today we want to concentrate on Claude Sullivan, who was a UK broadcaster for about a 20-year period, 47 to 67. And I guess I'll start, Alan, by just asking you what made Claude the person and broadcaster that he was. He went through a setback in high school. He was like all of us, wanted to play sports and did and was very good at it, but suffered a serious injury and illness, and that kind of redirected him a little bit. But tell me about that and what sort of went into the person that Claude Sullivan was.
Well, that's a question I've asked myself a lot, especially as I was going through the book Voice of the Wildcats, Claude Sullivan and the Rise of Modern Sportscasting. And I think it was he came from Winchester, Kentucky, small town near Lexington, from a very humble beginning. His father was a truck driver, and his grandmother was kind of an old-fashioned grandmother from Winchester. But at some point in time, he had an injury. He was very involved in basketball and football, was captain of the basketball team and as a sophomore. And he had an injury against Mount Sterling where he had a boil on his elbow, and it hit the floor quite hard. And after the game, he started getting red streaks in his arm of infection, and they took him to the hospital and eventually to Lexington. And he was diagnosed as osteomyelitis, which is curable today with penicillin, but in 39, it was really before penicillin was a mainstream drug. Mickey Mantle had the same illness,
right.
And he
mm-hmm.
had a lot of pain from it, but he lived with it and took antibiotics, so... So once he developed that, he had to have a surgery or threatened to lose his leg, and that was a possibility. But the surgeons in Lexington, Dr. Scobie, were able to cut out the infection, which caused one leg to be shorter than the other, and it obviously ruined any career choices of playing basketball for Adolph Rupp, which I think he obviously would like to have done. Every high school star in Kentucky would dream of that.
Mm-hmm.
Today or yesterday. But the injury took him a year to get over it, and he was bedridden because rest and staying still and elevated is what the doctors wanted. So he finally begged my grandmother to let him go to a basketball game to just see his teammates, and she agreed. She thought, the doctor thought, it would be healthy for his mental frame of mind. So he went to the game. And there wasn't a seat, it was packed. And they said, well, Why don't you sit at the scorer's table? As a matter of fact, the PA announcer's not here yet. If he doesn't show up, why don't you give your shot at it? So he thought, well, I'll try that. So he sat down at the press table, and he did the PA announcing. And at one point he said he made a comment about the sponsor being the funeral home director, and somebody was hurt. It was an injury timeout, and he started to laugh at what he had just said. But he enjoyed it. So he, from there, it's unclear, and I never got a chance to talk to him in detail about how he went to WCMI as a 17-year-old having just graduated high school.
Now, this was in WCMI. Was
WCMI in Ashland, in Kentucky, Ashland, yes. Right. And I don't know how he got there. And Billy Reed once said, wrote an article about that, and he said, Claude said, the pay wasn't very good, but neither was I. I think he made $12 a week in the 1942. Mm-hmm. From there, he started to court bigger stations, and he went to WAVE in Louisville. And while there, he started making audition discs, and there's a trail of a bunch of letters where he was sending to all the NBC and national executives, but it was right after the war, and people weren't hiring because they were waiting for the soldiers to come back. So his injury kept him out of the service, and he wanted to serve his country in a bad way, but he couldn't even get a desk job here in the States. They just wouldn't let him. So when he became able, he started making these transcription discs. As you know, they're the old 16 RPM records that were very steel with a magnetic overlay. And he was sending those to New York. He went to Radio City Music Hall and talked to the NBC executives up there trying to get a job in person. It was a very interesting trip, but he wasn't able to land a job. So he came back, and then he started with Chicago and after New York and different, even Cleveland, wherever he could find a bigger job. He went to Mount Vernon, Illinois, to a small town there near St. Louis, and then he went to Knoxville, WNOX. And he was looking for ownership and making himself more viable in the marketplace. So then he went to Cincinnati to, I'm trying to think of the station name now, it was in Cincinnati. He lived in Newport. Mm-hmm. He did Covington Homes games, and that's when he did his first high school state tournament, was 48. Covington Homes was in the semifinals. And that's when Carr Creek played, and he taped that game, Covington Homes and Carr Creek. So that's kind of how he got into it. Sometime there's letters that kind of document this. He met Ted Grizzard at WVLK, and Ted wanted Claude to come to Lexington to be on their team and to do sports. But he set up a contract with UK in 46 with Bear Bryant and then with Adolph Rupp the following year to do football and basketball. Anybody could do it that presented themselves and met with the coaches and could give a legitimate reason for being an announcer.
Yeah, much different setup.
Much different than today, where you have to be backed and right. Be with a syndicate, so to speak. So when he got in, Ted then said, wanted Dad in sales. Back then you had to do sales and everything to be on the staff.
Sure.
You couldn't
mm-hmm.
just be a sportscaster. It was a new business. So I had several letters with Dad and Ted talking about coming to have dinner in Winchester and all that. So they, I guess it was 48, he moved from, WZIP was the station okay. in Cincinnati, mm-hmm. and moved to Lexington and started a career with the other station. I'll get the name of it soon. Nobody knows what, WKLX, nobody knows what happened to it. We think it was in the Phoenix Hotel with VLK. And they just kind of changed named or absorbed each other. But I don't think Ralph Hacker knew. Nobody knows that I've talked to. But there's articles about KLX when they came on the air. And he was, again, doing news and had his separate contract to do sports with UK.
Now, you had mentioned some of the other places that he had worked, and he was looking for a national impact, you might say, or
right.
a national assignment. And that was part of the personality there, is a drive to succeed on that
yeah.
on a very high level. That seemed to be always there with him, wasn't
he
it?
He did, and I think you look at some of the other announcers, like Dad and Kaywood were friends like all the others, J.B. Faulkner, and I think that's what set Dad apart from the others, is that, you know, JB B went into Keeneland and got involved in that, and I think he saw Claude was starting to dominate the sports network in Lexington. Kaywiff never really went off and did national broadcasting. He did some national events and so forth, but Dad wanted to be, you know, the Al Michaels, and ironically, Al Michaels preceded him after he died at the Cincinnati Reds and became the national prominent.
Right.
And I think that was his launching pad, was the Cincinnati Reds job in 63.
Mm-hmm. But that was a part of his personality, and he used the principle, as he called it, the spokes on the wheel, and others, most notably Ralph Hacker, said that that was just a key conversation in his life to have Claude share that philosophy with him. But explain the spokes on the wheel and how that fit into Claude Sullivan's
career. It's Ralph's story, and I never, again, I was 16 when my father passed away of cancer, so I didn't hear a lot of these stories. I was with him at the games and worked the games. But Ralph said that they were at a meeting at the Phoenix Hotel. Garvis Kincaid had weekly meetings, and they were sitting in the back, and Dad had cancer, and he was fighting it, and he was still working, but he was kind of weak, and his voice was not real strong. And he pulled Ralph aside, and he said, "Let me tell you something. It is something that's helped me through my career, and I think you could use this advice." He goes, "I'd love to hear it from you." So he told him that he built a hub with VLK and his business as his main job. And then he built spokes to that hub to create a wheel that had high school sports, UK sports. He did some baseball for UK, and just branch out. That way you have several things that you can fall back on, or you can one spoke breaks, you put a new spoke in the wheel, and it keeps rolling. So that made a real impression on Ralph, and he told me that story when I interviewed him for my book, and that was glad he told me that, because that sounds like Dad and his kind of philosophy. He did as many things as he could, including the WVLK tours overseas, which he did for 5 years.
Yeah, and it's also a good insight into the broadcasting business, too, because there are times when an opportunity that looks good or has been good for a while suddenly will end, even for the best of broadcasters.
Right.
So he seemed to have that preparation in mind and made himself valuable in a number of different areas with the spokes on the wheel.
Well, preparation was his hallmark. I think Jim Host and Ralph both would tell you that mm-hmm. he pretty much taught them what he called the Sullivan system, which was back then you didn't have the internet to rely on or computers to gather information and technical information. It came from the publicity brochures that the other teams supplied you with, and doing your scorecards and having all the information there. And he had a very meticulous way of sitting down and doing that, and Jim said that he showed him his method when they were on the road one time and how to. And here they were both broadcasting for different companies. And then at one point in time, Dad was actually managing three networks. And I didn't realize that until I went through all the archival information. But Bluegrass Broadcasting was WVLK and 12 stations, including one in Florida. And Kentucky Central's network, he hired Jim Host to do the games and compete with himself, but he had different advertisers. So that was another way of getting more income based on, you know, the advertising is what drove it and always has.
Mm-hmm. Well, he certainly had a wide variety of experience. People know him best, of course, for the on-air work, but there were many other things that he was involved with during his career. We're talking with Alan Sullivan, the son of Claude Sullivan, and Alan is the author of Voice of the Wildcats, Claude Sullivan and the Rise of Modern Sportscasting. Alan Sullivan, along with Joe Cox, put together that book and brought back some recognition of Claude Sullivan's career, because as time goes on, of course, the people who listened to Claude on a daily basis grew older and passed on.
Yeah.
So this is kind of a way to rejuvenate that memory of his career. And Tom Leach, the current voice of the Wildcats, has pointed out on numerous occasions about the influence Claude had. And in particular, he was directed toward getting some tapes from you to learn a little bit more about how he might improve his football broadcast. Right?
Yeah, I guess that was in 99 before the Outback Bowl. And Jim Host, the way Jim Host told me this, he says, "I told Tom Leach, you need to get some tapes from Alan of Claude Sullivan, because he was without a doubt the best broadcaster of football that was ever on the air." So I happened to have, I was dealing with the archives, and now there's 460 tapes at the UK archives that are digitized. Then they had made some copies on cassette tapes for people that would come in and request a game. They wouldn't let them listen to the original. They'd make a cassette copy, and you could go in a booth and listen to the game. So I had a few of those on me, so Tom came by, and I gave them to him, and he listened to them on the way to Tampa to the Outback Bowl, he said. But I think he was talking about it when we had the first podcast about which games they were. One was a Tennessee game, I know, that Kentucky won at Knoxville, which was a rare thing to beat Tennessee anywhere, much less Knoxville.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely.
He had some good ones to be inspired by.
He did, and he has called attention to that, as I say, on several occasions as something that was influential to him, one of many broadcasters influenced by Claude Sullivan. One thing that I wanted to get into a little bit, with you was the ability at such a young age, when he became a voice of UK sports, to earn the respect of a couple of tough coaches like Bear Bryant and Adolph Rupp, who were the head coaches in football and basketball at that time. And yet they both right away seemed to respect Claude for his professionalism and the way he approached the job. And that's not always the case for a young broadcaster, whatever era you're talking about.
Right. I guess the friendship with Bear Bryant started in 46 when Claude arrived in Lexington and started doing the games. And Bear had been there maybe a year or two, or maybe that was his first year. I can't remember. But he was obviously the new coach, and everybody was interested in what he had to do. And somewhere along the line, when I interviewed Babe Parilli for my book, I was telling him about the letters. I said, you know, Bear Bryant invited the media to Millersburg Military Institute, for where they had their boot camp. And I said, I heard that was a tough boot camp. I'm surprised he invited the media. And Babe said, no, he didn't invite the media. He invited your dad and Babe Kimbrough or one other sports writer, but he didn't invite the media because he knew that what happened in Millersburg would stay there with Claude. He knew what he was supposed to say and what not, and he was just observing, so he learned about the team. So that I guess it was a very professional relationship, and Bear confided in Claude. They thought it would be funny to let Claude know the first three plays of one of the games so he could make himself look good, and it kind of turned around, and then it made him look so good the newspapers reported the next day after Dad correctly called the first three plays and the results that this football coach, Bear Bryant, doesn't have a very good offense when it seems that the sportscaster knows about more about what he's going to do than the coach does.
Yeah.
Something to that effect. And they had a good laugh about that. But Bear said, well, that kind of backfired on me, didn't it? I thought I was going to make you look good, but I didn't know I was going to make myself look bad.
Well, it certainly was a great era in UK sports at the time that he came on board as one of the broadcasters. And it seemed like it would go on for a long time when Kentucky's winning championships in basketball and even in football. But then things changed in the early 50s, and it was a whole different environment there for a while with, of course, the point-shaving scandal in basketball and the downturn in football fortunes after Bear Bryant left. And so kind of a different era of UK sports for him to cover after that great success of the late 40s, early 50s.
Yeah, I think he enjoyed that era, but the last game that Bear Bryant did was the 1953 win at Stahl Field over Tennessee. And Bear Bryant was carried off the field, and of course, they didn't know he was leaving. I don't know if he knew he was leaving at all at that point in time to go to Texas A&M. But my mom told me that Dad asked Bear why he was leaving. He said, you don't know if he was deflecting the question or not, because I don't think he would answer that one ever directly. But he said, Claude, they're offering more money down there. They're even offering me oil wells. So I'm sure that had a lot to do with it, but I think it was just the I think he and Adolph got along fine, but it was just the competition that Kentucky was already established as a basketball school, and he could see there was going to be a lot of competition in that realm. He goes to Texas A&M and Alabama, and they didn't have that competition. But they stayed in touch because he interviewed Bear in 62. I think that was the year he won one of his championships, and they stayed in touch. So it was a good friendship, and it was a very comfortable one for my father, I know.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the book too that after all that football success, that unfortunately he would never do another bowl game after Bear Bryant left, right?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
He did four NCAA championships during that same period of time, so that shows kind of where the program was. It was all basketball at that time.
Mm-hmm. But even then, the last one was 58. By Kentucky standards, a drought.
Another Bear Bryant story that kind of shows you the relationship is that I talked about this one a little bit in the podcast, is that after a rare home loss, my mom said that they had the no coaches shows in a studio back then. It was usually at the coach's house. And nobody wanted to go out to the house. They were afraid that what kind of mood Bear Bryant was going to be in and that he might not be too happy to be interviewed. So Claude went home and he said, "Alice, you know, I think we should go out to Bear's house, and I think it's bad that nobody shows up, and I have a feeling nobody's going to show up unless we go." So they went out to his house, and his wife answered the door, invited him in, and he acted surprised to see him there, and he said, "I appreciate you coming," and they had a good conversation. As they were leaving, Bear turned to Dad and said, "Claude, I really appreciate you and Alice coming out and seeing me tonight." He goes, "I guess those other son of a bitches were too afraid to come."
and he was probably right.
Yeah, he was probably right. So he had a good relationship. And they did the first national coaches show. By today's standards, it's hard to imagine that. But the Lincoln Mercury dealer, I think it was, I'll remember that name here soon. In Lexington, there was
a farmer for a long time.
But they sponsored the weekly show, and Bear predicted the scores of other games around the country and in the SEC. And he picked a favorite team to win, and they focused on that game. And that was the first time that was done nationally, and that was a big – and then he did the same thing the following year, I think, when he started the Adolph Rupp Show.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had a hand in his work, you and David, when you were growing up, and you got to help out a lot. And I guess really the trade-off was that your dad had to be away a lot, but then on the other hand, you got to be involved in some great things and had some great experiences as a result. Tell me about your involvement, yours and David's.
He had a lot of confidence in us. That was very supportive that he never questioned whether we could do something. He just asked us, and we did it. Mm-hmm. So I guess I started at probably 10 years old helping spot on the football games, and then David was 3 years older than me. He started engineering very young and, checking out the lines with the phone company and all that. And then I became a statistician. I got a little older at the basketball games, and we go back to the locker room to get Adolph for his interview with the state police following back there. So that was a big deal for me to get to go back to Memorial Coliseum locker room. But, yeah, it was a lot of involvement. I remember walking up those steps to the locker or to the press box at Stahl Field, about 48 steps before any elevators of Commonwealth, and lugging all that equipment up another stair to the booth. And we were right next to Kaywood. And Kaywood would hire me to do the scores of other games, and the radio station would call me in our booth. I'd have a clipboard with all the games, write down the scores, and go over and say, "Kaywood, here's the scores." And I think he paid me $10 a game just to do that for him, so we had a good relationship. And it built up to David did the Texas Western game in 66. He was 19. I was 16. I don't know why I didn't go, but I guess there wasn't room for me, or I was had school projects, but... And he had to check out all the lines up in Maryland and had a lot of issues for a 19-year-old and the guy that was standby for Dad to do the game in case he didn't get there from Tampa from the Reds spring training. He had to go back and forth after every game back to spring training in Sarasota to do a Reds exhibition game and then do the next game the following day. So David had some issues because Adolph had diabetes and he couldn't walk upstairs. So they had a crow's nest up in the top of the stadium in Maryland that had the interview booth, and he had to get him to set up a line down on the court so Adolph could sit down and not have to go upstairs. So it's a lot of responsibility for a 19-year-old. And then right before my father passed away, he was at Mayo Clinic. David and I went to Ann Arbor, Michigan to do the opening game of the season for the Kentucky team with Dan Issel, Mike Pratt, and Casey. And I remember going out to dinner with Kaywood and the gentleman who did the game for Dad, and I don't remember why we were there or anything. And David said, well, I think that wasn't after Dad passed away. That was right before he passed away. So, you know, those kind of things, those interviews come out that you kind of, I guess, block those kind of events out of your mind. But that's kind of what happened there. So we pulled it off. We were under contract, and Dad certainly didn't have any choice but let us do it. But I think he had a lot of confidence that we could pull it off after the Texas Western game.
Yeah.
So.
Well, let's talk about his baseball days.
Yeah.
He, of course, was part of the Cincinnati Reds broadcast crew and then became the main broadcaster and in a short time with the Reds. But that also enabled you and David to have some great experiences there, too. But let's talk first about Claude getting to the Reds and being able to spread out and, again, have more impact, which is what one of the things that he always had an eye on.
Right. Well, it kind of happened by accident. We were moving to Louisville because he got ownership with Bluegrass Broadcasting and WINN, and Garvis agreed that would be the originating station for the broadcast, not WVLK, but VLK would be an affiliate. So we were in the process of moving when he had already interviewed for the Cincinnati Reds, and he didn't really say anything about it to us because he didn't get the job in 62, and I think that's the first time he's ever not gotten a job he applied for. On his application, he said, this is the first job I've applied for in 14 years. So I'm kind of rusty at this, but he gave his explanation of why he wanted the job. They hired Gene Kelly in 62 to work with Waite Hoyt. And after 1 year, the two were like oil and water, and Waite said Kelly wouldn't go by the format they had set up of him doing three innings and Waite doing the others. And he would interrupt Waite, and Waite was very particular, but he'd done those broadcasts 32 years, mm-hmm. I think, at the time. So when Kelly didn't work out, Waite said to Bud Coons of Midland Advertising, who was running the search, said, who's that Irishman that came in here that I interviewed that didn't have much baseball experience, but I really liked him? Mm-hmm. And they said, well, yeah. I think you're talking about Claude Sullivan. He didn't have a lot of baseball experience. He had some college games and not that much, really. He goes, well, why don't we do this? Let's set it up so he can do a game for us, a Reds game, and let us use that as an audition tape. So that was kind of Bud's marching orders from Waite. So he got a Dad's tape recorder, and they got a program for him. And he went out, I think it was in the third field seats along the third baseline, and set up. They plugged him into an outlet at the column there, and he sat down and he broadcast. I think he did three games. They're on tape, and you had listened to one of them. Mm-hmm. We were talking earlier, and the reason I was scanning through all these tapes in the archives for my book was because this particular one was a little different because he did the whole game. It was a San Francisco Giants game with Willie Mays, and I was noting that the Reds won like 10-5, and the interesting thing was Bud Coons was the voice that said, I think we've got the other tape started, Claude, so we're going now. We missed part of that last inning. So that and the fact he did the whole game were clues that, yes, this it was actually an audition tape in October or September, I think, of 63. So he got the job, came back, and he and Waite worked together famously for the 1 or 2 years that before Waite's retirement. And, you know, his farewell address and all, Claude was there in San Francisco when he did his final game. They had a great relationship, and he stayed close to our family and came down and visited one day after my father passed away in the 80s and spent the afternoon with my wife and I just talking baseball. And mm-hmm. I'd never heard him talk about his career before. It had all been about the Reds.
Sure.
You know, it's mm-hmm. what people want to know is how the Reds doing. So that was kind of how that turned out. And we did go on a road trip with the Reds. They never typically allowed anybody to go from families on road trips, but Claude asked them, and he knew that they had seen us there at the ballpark and went down the field with him for batting practice and interviews. And they said, we're going to let you do this because we've seen your kids, they behave themselves, and let this be a trial. And of course, we never did another one, but I don't think it was because it was a problem. It was, you know, getting out of, I guess it was summer and we were out of school. We went to Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and New York when Shea Stadium was opening and Howard Cosell was starting to do TV, and Lindsey Nelson was the voice of the Mets, and he and Dad had been good friends from doing SEC games with Tennessee and Kentucky. So
that's, I think, an indicator, too. It's such a difficult challenge for people who are in the kind of work that he did to find a balance with family and work life. But
yes.
he and your mom seem to be able to make that work and to make it a good experience for everybody, despite all the demands on his schedule.
They did. As a matter of fact, when I interviewed my mom formally for the book, she said that one of the things that I asked her, I said, I guess you weren't really into sports originally. You just kind of were drug into it because of Dad's career. She said, no, I had three brothers. I grew up going to baseball games, and they worked on cars, and we went to basketball games. She said, I played high school basketball, and I've always really loved basketball. So that was kind of her connection. But we got a boat because he thought we took the boat up to Cincinnati, up through the river, through the locks, and went to the games. We went down to Madison, Indiana for the regatta. He planned his trips around work so that he could spend time with his family, and he always thought about that. He felt bad that baseball was taking so much of his time. And when he got cancer, one of the things I'm fortunate to have is his thoughts about what was going on, because he was losing his voice, and he started writing. And one of his letters to Mom was that, I think I'm going to think about saving my voice and maybe just going back to doing football and basketball at UK, giving up the Reds and spending some time with the boys, because I haven't been able to spend as much time as I've wanted to, and they're growing up. Mm-hmm. So, because if we had been normal and grown up and he had not had cancer, we would have moved to Cincinnati the following year, because the Reds wanted him full time, and he would have had to have looked at giving up Kentucky basketball and football, which would have been a really hard thing for him to admit, mm-hmm. but that was coming.
We talked about the versatility and the success he had in a number of areas in addition to his on-air work, but one thing that combined his on-air experience with his ability to capitalize on other projects was, you alluded to it earlier, his international experience, the WVLK
yeah.
tours in the 50s, and he did some important work during that time, and also I would think had a wonderful experience as well. But tell me about that part of his life.
That's interesting that you asked that question, because I'm just finishing up the last of the documentation I have for the archives, which is all, a lot of its information on his tours to Russia, the Middle East, Scandinavia, and Spain, Portugal, and the Olympics in Rome. The Olympics in Rome, he turned into a kind of a sporting event for himself in 1960, because the Olympic team had Adrian Smith, and he interviewed Adrian. He announced one of the games just for his own personal benefit. He had it on his miniature tape recorder, and that's interesting that that was available when I went through all the archive material that we had. But he interviewed Jerry West, and he didn't have any of the other, Jerry Lucas was there too, but he did go to Olympic Village. And I've just gone through the slides of all that those trips, and I can now see what he was talking about in his diary and on the recordings. The Olympic Village, now Tom Hammond said, you can't get anywhere near Olympic Village. It's so tightly controlled with the Israeli event years mm-hmm. ago. It's just, obviously, they want to keep the athletes separate. But he gave the guard at the gate something of significance. So he gave him a cigarette lighter that he was coming back. And he went in and he knocked on Adrian's door, and Oscar Robertson answered the door and said, oh, you must be Adrian's friend Claude. And so they went downstairs in the building. They had some practice facilities within the dorms that they had, and he had some photographs of the wrestlers that were practicing, and they had a Coke and talked a little bit. So he had a nice interaction with Adrian and some of the players out at Olympic Village, which I know he really cherished those moments to get out there. And he broadcast, like I said, one of the early games with the United States and Japan.
I want to hear some Claude Sullivan calls, and we'll do that in just a moment. But before we do, is there anything that just sums up your feeling about having put this project together and brought his career to the attention of many who may not have known about him before? What has all this meant to you?
Yeah. Well, it's been a great process. It's been a sad one, but it's been a closure and a happy one because I found so many treasures, not just in old programs from the bowl games back in Bear Bryant era, but in these, like, tapes. I've listened to all the tapes, and so did Joe Cox when he was working with me on the book, because Joe did not know Claude Sullivan at all. He was there to help me edit the book, and he listened, I think, probably to every tape, he would tell you, because he could quote games to me. But I think being able to listen to all the games that we have, the most fun I had in the book, I think, was putting together the 22 audio clips that are in the ebook. And that, even Dad describing the mask of Stalin or his body laying at state in the mausoleum in Kremlin Red Square, in an interview with Hank Williams. He had 80 interviews recorded from Cincinnati Reds and their other baseball teams, Stan Musial, mm-hmm. Casey Stengel. I mean, it's just, the list goes on and on. It's like a who's who. So that was fun. That was probably the most fun I had, because I could listen to his voice and I could hear his enthusiasm and feel his real desire for the game and what was going on at his fingertips. And some of the favorite ones, of course, everybody knows the Temple game, and that was probably the most clairvoyant thing, saying this could be the best play of the year, you know, and there it goes.
Yeah.
But how many people would think of doing that at the time? There were several other games, the Sugar Bowl game in 61 or 2 with Terry Mobley hitting a last-second shot against Duke to win that game. There's a lot of exciting games, and I really enjoyed I feel like I was bumming out and not really working on my book when I got to that part of it. But when I did figure out where they all went into the ebook and all that, was a lot of fun to put that together.
All right. Well, let's see if we can hear some of those calls now, and we'll do that with Alan Sullivan. He's the author of Voice of the Wildcats, Claude Sullivan and the Rise of Modern Sportscasting, and the son of Claude Sullivan. He and Joe Cox are the authors of the book, and we'll have more in just a moment.
In these uncertain times, turn to WUKY, your source for the latest information on the outbreak of COVID-19, both here in Kentucky and around the world.
Social distancing continues.
Now, more than ever, it's vital you have reliable, up-to-date information to protect yourself, your family, and your community.
We will get through this.
Stream us from wherever you are, 24/7 at WUKY.org or through our free app. Stay safe. And stay tuned to WUKY.
Alan, we certainly want to hear some of Claude Sullivan's great calls during our podcast segment here. And of course, preparation, as you said, was the key. He really worked hard at it, but he had challenges, as he said, in broadcasting assignments. And baseball presented one type of challenge to him. And horse racing, at which he was also outstanding, presented an entirely different kind of challenge. Mm-hmm. We're going to listen to a horse racing call from Claude Sullivan. But tell me about how he regarded doing the sports, baseball and horse racing, and the challenges they presented to him.
Right. Ray Holbrook told me that he sat at Keeneland at the press box with Dad for his feature race a lot of the times, and that he marveled in how he was able to pull that off. And he asked him one time, he said, Claude, how do you manage to do 2 minutes? There'd be 12, 14 horses with different colors. The names are all weird, and how do you memorize all that? And he would sit up the day before, and he'd have the program for the following day. And he would just practice, you know, saying all the names together and memorizing the jockey's colors, because a lot of times you couldn't see the number. And a lot of times, like you said, if it's raining, you can't see anything.
Right.
So it's really a hit-and-miss thing. That was probably the hardest thing to do, but he said the next hardest thing, or of equal difficulty, was baseball. It was sort of new to him. He'd done a little college work when he started with the Reds, but it's the gaps that you have. The mm-hmm. Wade Hoyt was so good at the rain delays that he could talk for 4 or 5 hours about the Yankees and his baseball. Dad didn't have those highlights of baseball because he never played baseball to bring out. So what he did was he said to somebody before opening day in 65, when he was the number one announcer, he goes, the thing I dread the most is a rain delay. And sure enough, that's what he got.
Yeah.
So opening day at Crosley Field in 65, he's had a lineup of people to come in, some of the assistant managers, some of the coaches, some of the players, some of the ex-players, umpires, whoever he could find. He had people bringing them in, and he just interviewed them for 3 or 4 hours. I don't know if the game ever was played or not, but that was his big fear that he had to deal with, was how to fill that gap. But it could be the quickest action that ever happens if you call a triple play. I mean, you can get tongue-tied before you even realize what happened.
Exactly. Baseball can go from 0 to 60 in a very short period of time. You mentioned the rain delays and the interviews and worrying about the rain delay. Of course, that would be one of your biggest challenges in following Wade Hoyt, because just for that reason that you mentioned, is that that's when Reds fans were maybe most entertained many nights, is when Wade would tell about his days with the Yankees. So that was certainly a challenge for Claude. And, of course, you're going to be self-conscious following anybody who's had such a long run of success as Wade Hoyt had on this broadcast.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Now, in basketball, we mentioned the great era that at the time that he joined UK as one of the broadcasters, and in 1949, that was a championship year, and I believe you have the call here of the championship game, is that right?
Yes, against Oklahoma and A&M, and he had the fortune of having been able to broadcast four Kentucky NCAA championships, all the ones that Adolph Rupp had. And that's the most of any announcer and the most of any coach. So he had that in common with Adolph.
And we'll hear Claude Sullivan calling the championship game, a bit from the championship game of 1949, one of the national championships for the Wildcats, and one of the four that he was involved in.
And Kentucky's going to shoot a gem line on the free throw lane, and only 5 seconds to play. The Wildcats leading 46-36. This will probably be the last shot of the ball game, and line misses. It comes off there, rebounded by Shelton. He flips over on the far side. 1 second, 1 second to play as Yates shoots and drops the ball on the floor. The game ends. The Wildcats are the defending champions. Wild Jones runs up and takes the ball away from Pilgrim. He wants that ball for his own. He grabs it, and boy, do they deserve it. The Wildcats have made a tremendous demonstration. We've got the man here that we want to talk with, Captain Alex Sosa. Al, how do you feel, boy?
Well, I want to say to all the people in Lexington, we're going to bring home the bacon to you, and we'll be in sometime next Monday before we have to go back to New York. And I know that your support back home as well as brought us through, and we're glad that we won, and I hope to see you people soon. Thank you, Clyde.
Thanks a million, Al, and good luck. That was Alex Groza of the Wildcats, who the minute the game was over, rushed over here to say hello to everyone around through Central Kentucky. We want to thank Al a million. Al did quite a tremendous job here tonight in Seattle, Washington. Hank Iba, who's rated among the top coaches in the nation, says that Bob Harris, his center, is the greatest college defensive player that he's ever seen, and probably of all times. Well, it takes an equally good center to score against him. Groza racked up 28 points against Bob Harris for the Aggies.
Claude Sullivan calling the 1949 NCAA championship game won by Kentucky. The Wildcats won again in 51, but then came back in 58 with the Fiddlin' Five, and Vernon Hatton was one of the leaders on that team, and he, in that the course of that season, made one of the most memorable shots in UK basketball history. Even to this day, if you named a top five game winners shots that had an impact on a game, that one would come up, and Vernon Hatton's name would come up, and it's Claude's call that's attached to that shot, isn't it?
Right. That was, I don't know if I was at that game. I would have been 7 years old, and I just started going to the games as my brother would let me go with my mom as Dad was calling the games. But I know that my mom said that with 1 second to go in the end of regulation, people started leaving. And Dad was chastising them, of course, by saying they sit through regulation and 5 minutes or 4 minutes and 59 seconds of overtime, and they walk away. And the mom said when he hit the shot, people were throwing their coats in the air, who were walking up the aisle with their hat. Everybody wore hats and coats. The gentleman did back then. It was kind of a dressy affair to go to a UK basketball game. But it was bedlam after that shot was made.
All right. Well, here's the famous call. Claude Sullivan calling the shot made by Vernon Hatton.
Well, it's Temple 71, Kentucky 69. The fans now begin to pour for the exits. They have set through 40 minutes of regulation play, 4 minutes and 59 seconds of overtime play, and they walk out. This could be the most thrilling play of the season, you know. This time, John Krigler will put the ball in play for Kentucky. Ed Beck under the basket, 1 second to go. Pass to Hatton from 35 feet. It's good! How about that? How about it? Vernon Hatton did it! And it's tied up. Ball game's over. Another overtime coming. Stand by, stand by. It looks as though Sputnik just went off. Coats, hats, sweaters, jackets, everything flying through the air as Vernon Hatton from 45 feet has hit a shot with 1 second to go in the overtime that leaves the ball game Kentucky 71, Temple 71, and stand by for another 5 minute overtime.
Vernon Hatton's famous shot, that was in 1958, and just a few years later, Kentucky was playing in the Sugar Bowl basketball event. That was a fairly common practice at that time, a major basketball event to go along with some of the postseason football, and Kentucky was playing in the Sugar Bowl basketball event that year, and Terry Mobley was the hero this time, and another great call by Claude.
Yeah, and that was back before Duke was really a powerhouse basketball team. They still had a good team, but it was before Coach K and their recent success. But that was an exciting shot. I know Terry Mobley, when I interviewed him, played it down, you know, but it was a last-second shot. It was a fairly long shot, and it was a big victory in New Orleans for Kentucky.
And, of course, all of these moments that we're talking about and now listening to, these really enhanced Kentucky fans' enjoyment of the game. I mean, this is why the radio broadcast means so much, because when we go back now, our memories are that we can read descriptions of the game, or maybe we can even have a photo of the game. But to hear him describe it right mm-hmm. there on the scene at that time, those are the ones that stay with you as a fan, aren't they?
Yeah, and I had the fortune of being able to sit next to him at the games, and I always kind of marveled at it, of how he would pull things together and always note the little facts that were interesting but you wouldn't necessarily think about. And that was just because of his excellent preparation. He was always ready to go. And I think even though I didn't announce like my brother, I was an architect, and I would use his act of being prepared and his developed a system so that I was always prepared going into a client meeting, and I know that's what I got from him just indirectly, mm-hmm. watching him work.
Well, here's the call, Terry Mobley with the winning shot in the Sugar Bowl event.
Kentucky has got the ball with 47 seconds to go in the game, 79-79. Duke no longer can call a timeout. Our chart shows them with the allowable limit of 5. Kentucky still has 2 more to go. And just as soon as Cron got possession of the ball, he called the timeout. Kentucky lost Larry Conley at 13:25 with his 5th personal foul. No Wildcat at the moment has as many as 4 personal fouls. For Duke, Buckley is playing with 4 fouls. Duke has sent a man to the scorer's table to check on timeouts. He's being notified that he has 5. That unless we go to overtime, Duke will not have another timeout. If we do go to overtime, each team is allowed another timeout. But Duke trying to work up a defense now for Kentucky, which has suddenly switched from an offensive a defensive problem to an offensive problem. The plans are being laid in the Wildcat huddle now to our left, off down at the baseline. 79-79, and one of the great comebacks of Kentucky Cage history here in New Orleans, Louisiana. Duke is out and ready to go. Mullins, Ferguson, Harrison, Buckley, Tyson. They stay with the 2 big 6'10 men. They've been able to shut off any in-close shooting by Kentucky. The 2 6'10 men have. Mobley will put it in play. He brings both Cron and Embry with him down deep in backcourt, but Duke offers no defense in backcourt. Harrison stands about a yard down into the backcourt with both stockings down around his ankles. Out of bounds, Mobley gives to Embry. The clock is running at 45 seconds now as Embry tom-toms his way up the backcourt. Kentucky trying to win it now. Up in the front court, Embry, closely guarded by Ferguson, moves to the right, back to the left, and gives to Cron. Kentucky setting on it deep now, holding the ball out of play. Here's Cron moving in, moving out, staying away with 28 seconds to go. Trying to get things settled down here. Against the 6'9", 10, Buckley, he moves and gives over to Embry. Kentucky's trying to freeze for that closing shot. Here's Embry moving to the right against Ferguson. Incidentally, Duke is not in the bonus. 15 seconds remaining. The clock running. Kentucky's going to set it up now and go for it. 11 seconds to go as Embry moves to the left. 10 seconds. It's down to Deacon and out to Mobley. Mobley breaks to the left. 7 seconds to go. Mobley is shooting. It's good. It's good. Mobley's hit. What can Duke do? 1 second left. It's all over. It's all over and Kentucky has done it. What a comeback. Kentucky came from behind and has whipped Duke 81-79. What a finish. Kentucky wins the Sugar Bowl, coming from 12 points behind. Vic Mova shakes hands with Adolph Rupp, moving down the floor under the basket where Mobley has just dropped in the Sugar Bowl championship basket. Bubas has Ferguson with him, trying to move him back toward the bench. Frank Harsher, Lexingtonian, moving down to shake hands with Ted Deacon. Cotton Nash being congratulated by what is a very large contingent of Kentucky fans here. Boy, what a comeback this is.
Claude Sullivan with the call of Terry Mobley's winning shot at the Sugar Bowl tournament. Alan, let's change settings here, and we talked a little bit about Claude's international experience, and in particular in Russia, and some of the archival material that you've been able to compile included an interview, or more than one, but an interview in particular here during his time in Russia. Tell me about this one.
He had many, many tapes, audio tapes, 8mm film, and 35mm still photography of all these trips. He had it documented. There's 5,000 slides. I don't know what happened to all the 8mm films. There are very few that survived. And the audio tapes we have in the UK archives, 31 from his Russia trip. Then there's the Middle East and others. But the first year he went in 56 was the first year tourists were allowed from the United States, that Russia opened their doors. And the CBS broadcaster Marvin Kalb was the intern at the embassy in Moscow. He and Dad didn't meet, but I talked to him by phone and found out that he had been there that year because the Cold War was really at a serious point of confrontation at that point in time, and both countries feared the other one and what would happen because they didn't know that much. There was a lot of ignorance about each other. So I think he enjoyed meeting the Russian people, and he enjoyed it enough that he took a tour. In 56, it was sponsored by WVLK. It may have been, was likely the only tour group in Kentucky that was a sponsored tour that year, and maybe he met two or three other tour groups over there, but there certainly weren't many people really wanting to go back then. So he developed good relationships with his tour guides and went back in 57 and took my mother and another group of tourists. And it was rough. It was rough because they had problems getting visas. Some people got left behind in Poland or Helsinki, Finland, and they eventually caught up. But his diaries carry that whole process throughout, and you kind of witness what happened. But it was not easy, and the Russians were not really wanting the American tourists there, so they did everything they could to kind of keep them from getting in the country. So in 56, he entered Helsinki by train, went through to Moscow from Leningrad, and again, has lots of photographs and some tapes. The tape that I think you're going to try to play is him describing seeing Stalin and Lenin laying at stake in the basement of the Kremlin mausoleum, and that's what Bob Hope viewed the two bodies and called them the cold cuts. So, but Dad viewed them twice and described the differences in the bodies and how they were preserved, and had great detail about how he marked that part of his tour. But he had, again, 31 tapes from Russia and I don't know how many in all together in the Middle East to the Holy Land in 58. And the last one was, again, the Olympics in Rome was the featured part of the tour in 1960. They stayed there a couple of weeks to watch most of the Olympics. And had he known that Cassius Clay was going to be the real standout from Kentucky of the Olympics, he missed that fight because he was moving on before the final. But that's when he got to see the Pope bless the athletes in St. Peter's Square and release pigeons, and then they had a procession that went to the Olympic Stadium, and he describes all that very well in tape and in his notes, diaries.
Well, in this case, Claude Sullivan, best known as Voice of the Wildcats, but in this case, he is reporting from Russia.
It was 2:15 when we queued up for our look at the bodies at the mausoleum, which is on the western side of Red Square, which runs north and south. We had a wait of about 30 minutes before actually entering the mausoleum, as we were several hundred back in the line. Everything is about the same as it was last year. Lenin is now in an Eisenhower type of black jacket. His head is not on the velvet pillow, which it was last year. There seems to be a metal type of object over both his body and that of Joseph Stalin. Stalin has been dead just over 4 years, while Nikolai Lenin has been dead a little over 32 years. It was 2:30 when we finally came out of the mausoleum and headed back for the hotel for lunch.
And that was Claude Sullivan on one of his reports from Russia during his extensive international experience back in the 50s and 60s. And, of course, as we moved into the 60s, Alan, that was the time that he got his baseball opportunity with the Cincinnati Reds. And certainly it was a great opportunity for him to move in alongside Wade Hoyt, the legendary Reds broadcaster, and then Claude eventually moved into the number one role when Wade retired. But he must have been very, very excited at the time that the Reds' opportunity came through for him.
Well, I think he went from the bottom of the spectrum when he didn't get it in 62, and then to have the second chance at the same job within a year was unprecedented. I think knowing that they wanted him, he just had to prove himself, was icing on the cake for him, because he prepared for it, did it, and they loved it, and he got the job. So,
well, there were some great players playing in Cincinnati at that time in the early 60s at Crosley Field, the home of the Reds. And here's a call from Claude Sullivan on a homer by the great Frank Robinson. You might recognize the base runners in this one, too.
There are two down. Pete Rose at second, and here's Frank Robinson. He walked in the first and homered in the fourth. So officially, Robbie is 1-for-1, batting .323. Robinson has 2 home runs and 6 runs batted in. The RBI leader is Gordy Coleman with 9 and Darren Johnson with 7 on this Cincinnati club right at the moment. Stallard and McCarver have just concluded a conference as Robinson moves in to bat. Line drive into the screen in left field for his homer. Stallard checks his runner off second. The pitch to the plate is smacked, the same spot. It is gone, a home run by Frank Robinson. Right at the foul pole. And we had the hole for just a second as the ball was less than a foot there. Rose has scored and Robinson scores. It is 3-1 Cincinnati. And the Reds' bats have come alive.
Claude Sullivan with a call of Reds baseball from the early 1960s. I'm not sure the exact year on that, but if Rose was playing 63 at least.
63 or 4, yeah.
Yeah, because his rookie year was 63. And, of course, Claude went on to become the principal announcer after the retirement of Wade Hoyt, following Claude's first two seasons in Cincinnati. Back to basketball as we'll kind of wrap things up with this one. The 1958 team, Rupp called him his Fiddlin' Five, but they put things together and won the tournament and a victory in the championship game over a great Seattle team, led by a great player, Elgin Baylor, of course, who went on to a tremendous career in the NBA.
There are 29 seconds to go. The national championship lays on that line. Kentucky leads 80-70. Bernard Hatton moves in against Francis Saunders. Here's the tap to Don Mills. Under the basket. Cox lays it in. Johnny Cox gets his 10th field goal. He leads Elgin Baylor in that department. Here it is under the basket to Frizzell. Another check us, yes, Frizzell laying in his first field goal of the second half. Kentucky is on top now, 82-72. Here it is to Don Mills, whips it over. Vernon Hatton jumps, lays it in. And for Vernon Hatton, that's his 8th field goal. There are only 5 seconds to go. Kentucky has a 12-point lead. Elgin Baylor takes the last shot of the ball game. No good. And the hey, boy, the national champion, Kentucky Wildcats. Don Mills being mobbed by Kentucky partisans. Vernon Hatton, everybody pours out on the floor from the Kentucky bench. There are flash bulbs going off that almost blind you as Adolph Rupp digs his way through the crowd, finds Johnny Castellani in center floor, gives him a big hug. Both coaches slap each other on the back and part quickly as every move Adolph Rupp makes is being recorded by movies and still cameras. There is a mob scene under the Kentucky basket off to our right as handshakes go around. The first guy to congratulate Adolph Rupp is Earl Atkins, who went out, gave him a big handshake, a pat on the back, and now the kisses come from the cheerleader. The ushers line up around the court to keep all the spectators out. The Kentucky cheerleaders lead the parade. Here's A.B. Happy Chandler in the middle of the huddle now. This will absolutely, beyond a doubt, go down as the coaching year for Adolph Rupp. Took a team that many thought was not strong enough to win the conference title, was not strong enough to put a single man on the all-conference team, but has been strong enough to come out and take the national championship for the fourth time.
That was a memorable game for Kentucky fans and a memorable call for Claude, too, I would think.
Yeah, that was a special team for him. He knew Vernon Hatton and those players extremely well. And I think one of the reasons, even before that, when you go back to the 48-49 team, was that because some of the players had been in the service and were coming out and going back to school, Alex Groza was actually older than Claude because he started out in his mid-20s announcing. So, but this team, with Vernon Hatton being from Kentucky, and there always seemed to be a good local connection on some of these teams, and the fact the game was played in Freedom Hall didn't hurt either.
Right. They played, two games?
Can't do that anymore.
Two games in Lexington and two games in Louisville, yeah. I think. So that was nice. Things
well, back
worked
then,
out.
It was the home team advantage because that's what drew the crowd.
Sure.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Now people travel and they transport and they have to have neutral courts and there's very little, you know, play in one city and play in the next town the next year. It's just kind of a whole different method of scheduling.
Exactly. And of course, with television being such a huge factor now too, it doesn't matter so much whether you draw a huge crowd or not. They certainly
Memorial Coliseum had the after Dad passed away that year, Mom took the company and we were under contract. We ran it. David and I produced the games and we had Jim Host and a couple other announcers, Ray Holbrook and a few sit in for Claude, but we went through that season and at the end of the season Memorial Coliseum was an NCAA regional site, so Mom had to put together all the paperwork for that, which isn't nearly as complicated as it is today.
Yeah, that was 68 then.
It would have been 68.
Yeah, that was the year I think they lost on the last second shot to Ohio State, or they would have gone to the Final Four.
I believe so, because they beat Ohio State either earlier in the year or the year before at Memorial Coliseum with Lucas, Siegfried, and Havlicek.
Well, certainly many great moments that people will connect Claude Sullivan to in UK basketball history and Cincinnati Reds history, too, for that matter. And we've been talking with Alan Sullivan, Claude's son, and the author of Voice of the Wildcats, Claude Sullivan and the Rise of Modern Sportscasting. And Alan, there are just so many great stories. We could go on and on, but we should probably wrap up.
I'd have to refer
here
to my book to have any more stories. This is all I can get from my memory.
That's just fine. But anyway, we appreciate the
I've enjoyed
time and good to talk with you again, and thanks for sharing with us, and we appreciate having you on.
Thanks for having me, Keith. Okay. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to the Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.